everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, fake news, the rise of a new McCarthyism in journalism, news reporting, and free speech. My guest today from Austin, Texas, later will be Professor Robert Jensen. He's professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, and his research has focused on many diverse progressive social issues, including race relations, foreign policy, feminism, postmodern masculinity, the media, and others. He is a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center and a national organization Cultural Reframed coordinator. He has authored many publications, including his forthcoming The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. Other recent books include Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to the Planet Gracefully, as well as Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. He is also co-producer of a major documentary on the life and philosophy of longtime radical activist Abe Hosseroff, and his articles regularly appear in Truth Dig, Counterpunch, Yes Magazine, and his website is robertwjensen.org. Also today, we'll be having Rob Call, that's K-A-L-L, from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He is an American journalist and founder of the progressive liberal news site Op-Ed News, which was launched in 2003. In addition to being a longtime anti-war activist, Rob is also an inventor and an early inventor of technology that has gone into biofeedback science. And he has hundreds of publications, and he writes regularly, of course, for Op-Ed, as well as other publications. And his website is opednews.com. And he also hosts Bottom Up Radio on WNJC near Philadelphia. And finally, we have Eve Smith. Eve Smith is in New York City, and he is the founder of the influential financial and news blog Naked Capitalism. And he is the author of Econ, How Unenlightened Self-Interest Undermined Democracy and Corrupted Capitalism. It's an important investigation into how the symptoms associated with our economic crisis take precedence over the more important cause for economic collapse, which resides in the unquestioned role of economics as policymakers. And for over 30 years, Eves has been a Wall Street veteran as an investment banker with major firms such as Goldman Sachs and a corporate financial advisors. His articles have appeared in Bloomberg, Politico, State and Slate, I should say, Christian Science Monitor, and his website is nakedcapitalism.com. Nice to have you all with us today.
Great to be with you.
Glad to be here.
Good. We're going to begin by taking a look at the rationale for the Washington Post, in my opinion, outrageous article by Craig Timberg that listed alternative news sources and labeled them as a source of fake news, which claimed to be based upon claims that Russia is playing some kind of role in the rise of these sites' popularity and influence on the public. The Washington Post wants us to believe that news stories and commentaries distributed from these sites are erroneous and part of a Russian covert psychological operation to undermine the United States government and our elections and our democracy. At least from these individuals, we're told, do not trust what they say, do not believe what you read, because it's all lies. And at least for those who still believe the U.S. represents a legitimate democratic rule of governance and to hand the election victory over to Trump. And other mainstream sources have picked up on this, including Bloomberg, MSNBC, CNN, PBS, USA Today, Slate, NPR, and the Daily Beast, and others, without challenging this story at all. There has been an outrage directed at the Post across the internet and demands its article be retracted in large part because of the source of the Post's information, a dubious group calling itself Proper Not. Glenn Greenwald has accused Proper Not and hence the Washington Post with McCarthyite tactics. And to the best of my knowledge, the Post refuses to remove the article, nor will it apologize. So since your news and commentary website, Naked Capitalism, which usually features some of the most important and insightful independent economists, such as Michael Hudson, who we just had on this program 2 days ago, is among the 200-plus news sources being referenced by the Washington Post, I'd like to begin with you providing an overview of this incident to the best of your research, and why Naked Capitalism and why the other sources of similar journalistic and scholarship in quality, such as Truth Out, Truth Dig, Bob Perry's Consortium News, Op-Ed News, and Counterpunch, that were all libeled, in my opinion, and do not promulgate far-out conspiracy theories, they also have not been contacted by the mainstream media. They also are being viewed upon as unworthy, and yet these are some of the best sites to get accurate quality information. The forum is yours.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's important to understand a little bit of the detail about how the Post made this slur. They quoted the site Proper Not, and they basically tried to have it both ways by saying that Proper Not had a list of 200 websites, and then say, oh, but we've seen this report pre-publication. It's not coming out until, you know, the next day, when in fact the list was up on their site. On Proper Not's site, I had already seen it before the Post article ran. I decided to ignore it because the site was so inconsequential and hysterical looking and was getting no traffic. I thought, you know, why feed a troll? What's particularly damaging about the original version of the site, and these elements are still up, is not only does it have this list of 200 websites, which also includes conservative sites. This is an attack across the spectrum. It includes the websites of former Reagan officials David Stockman and Paul Craig Roberts, and it also includes former Senator Ron Paul's website. It looks as if the common element, aside from picking a few sites which clearly are, you know, Russian government funded, there's a handful of Russian government funded sites are there, like RT, and then WikiLeaks is the only other sort of site of real size on the list. Basically, everyone else on the list is probably there because they are deemed too small to pursue legal action. I suspect that that's one of the common elements for being included on the list. But in any event, there's a FAQ, frequently asked questions section of the site, which was one of the only two pages up as of the time the Post article ran, which says literally that these sites are probably, and some of these sites, quote, some of these sites are, you know, basically Russian agents and should be investigated by the FBI and the DOJ. These are the most strong, hysterical claims I've ever seen made against independent writers. And they similarly claim in item 11 of their FAQ that we have foreign controllers. I mean, it's just sort of stunning how reckless this is. And yet the Post ran and legitimated this scurrilous attack. I mean, it's just really shockingly shoddy. One of the few sort of upsides of this incident is that, you know, slowly the mainstream media is turning. And, you know, even though initially this was amplified and critically, the mainstream media is increasingly turning on the story. The New Yorker last Friday ran an article that was written by someone who's written about bona fide Russian propaganda sites and called the site that attacked you know, the others on this interview and the other, some of the other sites you and I mentioned, they called PropNot itself a propaganda site. The journalistic watchdog FAIR similarly ran an article last Friday saying, why are people promoting this clearly bogus fake news story? But nevertheless, you know, this, the fact that it was out there is incredibly damaging.
Thank you for that overview. Robert, lists of fake news sites have been on the Internet for quite a while. For example, there is Fake News Watch, and so there is nothing new about this site. Basically, fake news is defined as sources of hoaxes lacking credible supporting evidence. Then there are news sites called clickbait, which are sites that take bits of real news stories, make up or add further details, and often, but not always, frame the stories in a conspiratorial context. And usually these lists are confined to the most conspiratorial-related web sources, such as Alex Jones, InfoWars, and Prison Planet, and others of that nature, or sites that are nothing more than hoaxes, such as The Onion or The Spoof. So is The Washington Post attempting to redefine fake news and expand its meaning over and beyond simply conspiracy hoaxes? And then the question is whether or not this is setting a new precedent that can eventually lead to dramatic government acts of censorship to suppress news sources that challenge the stories and actions coming out of Washington.
Well, as you, I'm sorry, I was getting some feedback there. As you point out, there've been websites that promulgate all sorts of crazy things. Some that are obviously false. Some heartfelt by people who believe conspiracy theories of various kinds. So in that sense, there's nothing new. I don't know what really went on within the Washington Post, but as someone who's worked in newsrooms and teaches journalism, my guess is that the Post simply bought into a fraudulent story and then found it hard to back their way out of it. I assume that it's not part of some larger project on the part of the Post, clearly, but it can be hard for reporters who swallow a really obviously bogus story to walk that back. And my guess is that's probably what's happening here. But as you point out, it's not just a question of the Post. It's a question of the whole political culture. You know, fake news used to be a problem for teachers trying to, you know, get young people to understand the difference between reliable information and clearly falsified information. But now it's a part of the political culture. And the effects are much more dramatic, especially when you add in, as we saw in this last election, the profit motive that people generating fake news can find ways to make money out of it. I don't know that it's part of some grander scheme to undermine democracy and freedom of the press. My reading of history is often these things are just the product of bumbling more than anything sometimes. But it is disturbing, especially when you consider the Trump administration and its consistent calls to punish opponents, to constrain freedom of expression. From my point of view, nothing is clear about this at this point, whether we're talking about the intentions of the people who put up these sites or the intentions of the Trump administration. But there are certainly reasons for concern. As a journalism professor, it's sad to see the Washington Post refuse to at least acknowledge the mistake and correct that mistake and ask itself, why did we, in fact, swallow this story? That's where I would start with this critique of the Post.
All right. I'm going to come back to you in a moment on another issue. But back to you, Yves. When you take a look at the last campaign, and once WikiLeaks began to release over 40,000 emails, many of them about John Podesta, who was running Hillary Clinton's campaign, and a long time, along with his brother, power broker in official Washington, we began to see the conversations that we would never have been privy to, the allegiances, the betrayals, how they think, how they were framing their arguments, not the least of which was that there was an active effort to undermine Senator Sanders. And this was both with the Clinton camp immediately, but also with the Democratic National leadership. Now, at the point where that became public knowledge, I believe there should have been a public discourse between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, especially since Sanders had millions of young, more idealistic millennials who wanted to believe that politics could be improved, who wanted to believe that Democratic, let's say the whole Democratic platform could be expanded to include issues they were behind, and then it never happened. And instead, what we had down the line with everyone, MSNBC in particular, was a group of cheerleaders saying, now remember, this is all from Russia, and look at the source. And so we weren't supposed to understand the content and the context of the content. We were simply supposed to dismiss anything said about WikiLeaks because it came from Russians who had control over WikiLeaks. Well, Julian Assange stated, the information we're releasing is not from Russia. They're not telling us to release any of this. And he also said, show me where we're wrong. We've released 10 million pieces of information, 10 million documents. We have never been wrong on one of these. So once again, instead of people saying, what does the information say? What are they actually exposing? They said, damn the source, and therefore you don't have to listen to it and you don't have to feel that anything's wrong. So that said, do you feel that this horrible piece of journalism in the Washington Post is a sign of desperation within the mainstream media firms due to the poor perception the public has about corporate news in general and the decline in readers and viewers? And what would be the most important reasons you perceive for the public's loss of trust in the industrial news complex?
Well, this is a very big question, but let's see if I can address it pretty quickly. I must confess that I have, as you're implying, a less benign view of this than the professor does. Because there's been a long-term trend. It's basically started since 2002 with the SOPA and PIPA fights over net neutrality to try to allow, you know, those have been to try to allow the different pipeline providers to restrict access to content and have preferred content providers basically pay them more. Part of that would be to have preferred content providers pay them for access, to prefer, you know, faster download speeds and better access, which would, of course, work to the disadvantage of small sites, you know, smaller sites. So if you look over a larger time frame, there's basically been ongoing opposition, ongoing net neutrality fights to try to restrict, to try to basically squeeze out the small fry, you know, the sort of mammals that are going up against what increasingly media dinosaurs. What's happened to the traditional newsroom is that advertising revenues have collapsed. If you go back to and look at sort of the historical trend of ad revenues, they peaked in 2000, and they started declining dramatically then, not because of the competition from smaller news sites, but because of Craigslist and eBay, because the biggest source, half of advertising revenues for newspapers, which have long been the people who really did the day-to-day, you know, gumshoe work of investigative reporting, that was half, and that just basically has almost entirely evaporated. And then if you look at the trajectory of where ad dollars have been going more recently, again, it's not the smaller sites that have been cannibalizing the big sites, it's Facebook. Facebook overwhelmingly has benefited from the growth of advertising, of online advertising. So, you know, to the extent they're, you know, this is an effort to shoot at the small sites, it's more like they're shooting at the only available target as opposed to shooting at what's the real problem. And with this era of greatly decreased news, you know, journalistic budgets and newsroom sizes, one of the effects has been that journalists have become more and more dependent on access journalism. There aren't as many people to do original reporting. They still need to fill the same number of pages. And it's frankly much easier to take stories from a source that you regard as legitimate, which therefore makes that gives that over time those sources have more and more power. And, you know, that's always been a problem with political reporting to begin with. You know, it's sometimes a problem with business reporting, where if you for example, analysts who report critically on a company will be frozen out of analyst calls. You know, if you report critically on the government, you'll be frozen out of, you know, access to special stories and interviews, the kind of layups that get, you know, like the interviews of, President Obama, interviews of Timothy Geithner or Jack Lew, you know, Treasury secretaries. Those are very juicy stories, and you'll never get those if you don't play ball. And so, yes, the public senses increasingly that the press is more and more beholden to important business and political sources and doing less and less real, you know, nitty-gritty investigation.
I don't disagree with that analysis, but I also don't think that leads necessarily to the conclusion. The Washington Post editorial staff promoted that particularly noxious story as a result of some coordinated effort. I think it's true the news industry's business model has been in collapse for the better part of a decade, and all of that is accurate. And the longstanding problems with U.S. news media being too beholden to official sources has been well documented for going on about five decades now. But the question about this particular story, I think, isn't necessarily answered definitively by that. And I'd also like to go back to the question of those Podesta emails. And a lot of us on the left have been critical of WikiLeaks for the decision to dump that data, not because it made the Democrats look bad, but because when we start saying that even the emails of people who are not currently in government can be put into the public, we're erasing the little bit of privacy that we might all agree on. And I think there are real consequences to that. And a number of people on the left have criticized that particular one. What we learned from those Podesta emails, actually, from my point of view, wasn't that interesting, that the mainstream Democratic Party was not hospitable to an outsider, Bernie Sanders, who, let's admit it, has never been a member of the Democratic Party, that they were not hospitable to an insurgent candidate is hardly surprising. And the kinds of things they were saying are the kind of things that people in politics say. So it's not, I think, the source of so much actual real insight into what's going on. And I think it does raise the question of WikiLeaks' judgment. They also, within the last year, have done a massive data dump out of Turkey that put private citizens at risk and put out into public data that really was not beneficial to anyone. So there are real questions about this. And I think we should be more careful in evaluating the value of some of this and the implications of it.
But I also have to look at all the other data that they have given us that has been very insightful that we would not have known of. And as someone who is my entire career a progressive, I'm always astonished at how many people in different administrations, so-called liberal administrations, even the Clinton's first administration, virtually stayed silent when any type of incursion into our rights occurred, but only speak out later when someone from the opposition should attempt to do that. And there's been no major mass demonstrations against the invasion of our privacy by these overreaching agencies, the National Security Agency, the CIA. In fact, one of the things we learn is that more than $500 million a year is spent by the Pentagon trying to influence news by having people work for it full-time every day, including trolls and people planting information or attacking other people who have good information, for example, Seymour Hersh. And if it came to trusting Seymour Hersh and his reporting on some of the issues that we would not have known about, or trusting the New York Times that has consistently aligned itself both ideologically with Clinton, but also has refused to take on some of these issues, I would side myself with a Hersh, even if he is not given the same time and energy and forums that others would have. So, Robert, would you follow up on the earlier comment, because you are a professor at a notable school of journalism, who's turning off mainstream news such as the Washington Post or the New York Times or Fox or MSNBC or CNN and others? Are there certain demographics or social groups that are less likely to turn to mainstream media for information? And since you are actively involved in educating the millennials, where do they stand with respect to the mainstream media and independent media?
Well, in a sense, I think the reading habits of young people are not that dramatically different from that of older people. One thing we know about media through research is that it's a habitual question. I grew up always reading a daily newspaper. I will always read a daily newspaper till the day I die, probably. That our media habits are like other habits. They're not based purely on, you know, rational judgments. They're how they're woven into the fabric of our daily lives. And millennials, young people, clearly have different media they go to. But it's still true that the mainstream media is, I think, the foundation of the modern mass communication system in this country. As people have pointed out, even when you're reading various sorts of online sites that aren't part of the corporate commercial media, much of the basic information that feeds those sites does come from those mainstream media outlets. And so we're still very much a society in which the picture of the world most people get does come from that mainstream media. We also are in a highly ideologically fragmented world with easier distribution channels that produces, as people have pointed out again, bubbles where it's easier to avoid interaction. But again, I always go back to pointing out this is not merely a question of the media. It's a question of the political culture. It's a question of how people have been systematically pushed out of an idea that politics is engagement, that politics is something ordinary people do. The most troubling trend I see in my students is their belief that there is nothing political that is worth their time, that they look around and they see sleazy politicians, they see corrupt parties, they see no place for them to interact. The traditions of more grassroots political organizing, of resistance, of, you know, the time-honored progressive left radical feminist political movements are increasingly just not part of their world. And again, that's not only a failure of media, it's a failure of education. I routinely find students who had no exposure to these kinds of questions in the high school, often in much of their college career. And I think that's what we're dealing with, is the collapse of a political culture that understands democracy as something that ordinary people participate in. I'm not saying there was some golden age when democracy worked perfectly, where money didn't skew the results, where the process was open to everyone. That's a fantasy. But there's a kind of cynicism that I see throughout the culture, and especially in young people, that simply says there's no way to have a role in this. And that's a problem sometimes that we see in their media consumption, but I'm not sure it's a problem created by the media.
I'd like for you to follow up on that. Could you add anything to Bob's comments? And then, do you believe the Washington Post article could be a harbinger for a new kind of McCarthyism to take hold that could result in the censoring of sites such as your own and publications that challenge Washington or the corporatocracy that is so prevalent in Washington, especially when Trump enters the Oval Office?
To the first question about sort of cynicism about democracy, there have been developments in, you know, such as Citizens Unite being the most dramatic, but I'm not sure the cynicism of young people isn't fully warranted. You know, they look at a system where politics is dominated by money to a much more visible degree than you know, say since the era of the trust busting. Where, you know, that hold was finally broken. And it's simultaneously a time where people perceive protest to be dangerous. I mean, the people in the 1960s who, and people aren't willing to make the sacrifices that they were used to. People who protested in the 1960s were willing to and often did go to prison. Today, I know people who object to, you know, things that the government is doing, and they aren't even willing to risk being in jail overnight. You know, that you know, when they'd be able to get the charges wiped from their record. You know, and you know, similarly in this day of extensive background checks, if somebody were arrested as a protester, it would hurt their ability to be employed. And you've got kids now who are in most cases loaded up with student debt, who are having trouble finding a job to begin with. So you know and they can look and see that, you know, Occupy Wall Street lasted all of 2 months, that it was subject to a 17-city paramilitary crackdown. There's been an underlying authoritarian drift in our society in terms of some of the basic architectural elements that I'm not sure these kids, I mean, I'm in despair to see it, but I'm not sure it's ill-founded. To your second question about, you know, sort of larger movements towards McCarthyism, again, one of the reasons that I'm more disturbed about this development than Robert is, and I think there's more of a ideological underpinning than he wants to acknowledge in this Washington Post piece, is that there are other elements going on in parallel to try to get sites designated as fake news sites and delegitimate them. One is that there's been, and this has been ongoing for months, there's been a call for Facebook and other, you know, sort of major, what you might as well call choke points, and sort of, or information, Twitter also, sort of, you know, important nexuses where people, you know, inform each other in the social media as to what's going on, to have certain sites barred from them as being fake news sites. There's also been a movement afoot to, and this was discussed in detail in a recent Financial Times article, to have browser attachments designate certain sites as unreliable. And you can easily see those sites give the same kinds of warning. Don't trust this site, and the site and the warning looking awfully similar to a malware warning. You know, if somebody wanted to, you know, and browsers update in, most people don't even know when they've downloaded a browser. They're not that easy, a browser extension. They're not that easy to get rid of, and they update innocuously in the background. I mean, this is, there are multiple channels for them for basically internet censorship to be implemented that are already under discussion and moving forward. I mean, this is a really imminent threat, and I'm you know, a bit distressed to see that some of the sites that have been targeted feel that, you know, merely issuing an objection on their site is a sufficient response. You know, the intent really is to start cutting off the air supply to smaller sites that are a commercial threat to the mainstream media. I mean, this is partly, you know, I don't imagine that their treatment of borderline cases is going to be favorable to the people who are borderline cases.
Well, just as one example of that, take a look at Wikipedia and get yourself on Wikipedia, then try to correct the errors in the attack or the character assassination. It's virtually impossible. And I'm speaking on behalf of dozens of individuals who've done quality work and all say the same thing. We can't get it corrected. And then look at some of the people feeding Wikipedia. So I don't see this as being benign, and I believe that once they start the attack, something can occur for them. And we're joined by Rob Call. Welcome to the program, Rob.
And Hi, thanks for having me.
And you just heard Eve talking about From Naked Capitalism for her comments as to why her news sources would be blacklisted by the Washington Post. Well, Op-Ed News is also on the prop or not watch list. Why Op-Ed News? And briefly, note Op-Ed's mission as a reliable source of news and opinion essays. And why do you feel your site is a threat to the corporate media?
Well, we give a different narrative than the corporate media do. We challenge the establishment narrative and message, and we do it with original reporting from around the world. We've had people at Standing Rock. Today we published an article from Aleppo, Syria, from one of our writers. But you know, I think we're on the list because we published some people who criticized U.S. policy and its relationship to Russia, particularly Ukraine. And I think that's probably the case for most of the progressive sites that are on that proper not list. We also, you know, we have a guess about one of the people behind Prop or Not. His articles are cited by a proper not a number of times, and we actually ran an article about him and the kind of disinformation and the story he's telling. I guess we've got lots of reasons that Prop or Not would list us. But I agree that we the alternative media are becoming a threat to the mainstream media. The mainstream media are joining the ranks of Trump and Clinton in terms of being disliked and distrusted. And I think the alternative media is a place where people are going, and we're nibbling away at the mainstream media's viewership, readership, and I think it's adding up.
Rob, isn't there a danger of lumping sites such as yours and Naked Capitalism, Truth Out, and Truth Dig into the same targeted dustbin with sources that are clearly fake and intended to generate fear and provoke hatred based on gross misinformation? And doesn't this have a serious detrimental impact on real progressive sites that are dedicated to good journalism and critical thought?
I would say absolutely. I think it's dangerous. I think what's going on is very dangerous. I think we're seeing a new McCarthyism that Hillary Clinton and her campaign had a lot to do with getting started, and before her, neoliberals within the Democratic Party were very involved with. But, you know, the other side of it is there are libertarian sites listed in there, too, and and they're giving a different narrative too. And I wouldn't call anti-war Justin Raimondo's site, for example, a fake news site. But it certainly gives different perspectives than progressive sites do. This is dangerous. This is really dangerous.
Well, that's why we're doing this special. I want to thank all of you for coming on and sharing your points of view. We're going to take a break and come back with John Pilger, one of the most important journalists who has uncovered this type of information for a long time, and get a perspective from him. So Professor Robert Jensen and Robert Cowell and Eve Smith, thank you all for being with us today. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Every time I speak your
These days, we have 24-hour news. The sound bites never stop, and the wars never stop. Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine. This film is about the war you don't see. Drawing on my own experience as a war correspondent, it will look mainly at television, concentrating on the most popular channels in America and Britain. The film will ask, what is the role of the media in rapacious wars like Iraq and Afghanistan? Why do many journalists beat the drums of war, regardless of the lies of governments? And how are the crimes of war reported and justified when they're our crimes? A pioneer of modern propaganda was this man, Edward Bernays. Bernays invented the term public relations. He wrote, "The intelligent manipulation of the masses is an invisible government which is the true ruling power in our country." He was part of a secretive group called the U.S. Committee on Public Information, set up in 1917 to persuade reluctant Americans to join the war in Europe.
Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann go to Woodrow Wilson and say, look, man, if you're going to enter into this war, we are going to need to sell this war to the American people. And so Wilson institutes and creates the first modern propaganda machinery. It was actually quite brilliant in its conceptualization, so that the best way to persuade people is to grab them by their emotions, by their unconscious and instinctual urges. Let's not bother with pumping out facts. Let's scare the hell out of people. A picture of the Statue of Liberty in tatters, crumbled into the New York harbor with German planes flying around it. A picture of the world being gobbled up by the bloody hands of a gorilla wearing a German helmet. So, you know, it's not about facts anymore. The facts don't matter.
For Edward Bernays, public relations was like a war on people, on bending their will. He persuaded women to smoke at a time when smoking in public was not considered ladylike. He convinced a group of debutantes to parade along Fifth Avenue, holding up Lucky Strike cigarettes as symbols of women's liberation. To his delight, the press called these torches of freedom.
What he was interested in doing was creating an association between a product, in this case cigarettes, and the desire for women's liberation. It worked in the sense that it got lots of news coverage. It worked in the sense that women started smoking publicly, and in fact, smoking became a symbol of the new woman, of the emancipated woman.
Love is like a cigarette. You know you held my heart aglow between your fingertips.
Iraq, March the 20th, 2003. The creation of illusions and the selling of war had come a long way since Edward Bernays. The selling of this invasion depended on the news media to promote a series of illusions, like the link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11.
The vision of the World War I poster of the Statue of Liberty in a shambles in New York Harbor is not that different from the image of the World Trade Center, a burning symbol that sort of entered into the stock footage of people's dreams. So immediately, you have these associations between the image of the World Trade Center and Saddam Hussein and Iraq.
But Saddam Hussein had absolutely nothing to do with it.
Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with it, but that didn't matter. Because when you start using symbols that have been separated from their meaning and have sort of taken on a life of their own, the facts don't matter anymore.
This is the Pentagon, which spends almost $1 billion a year just on advertising, recruiting, propaganda, the selling of war.
There are Pentagon contracts with news organizations in terms of how to manipulate the news. There are Pentagon officials involved in press releases that go to the media, in which intelligence is used to manipulate public opinion, which is a violation of the charter of any intelligence organization. Then you have retired generals who serve as press spokesmen for all the networks, and it's never revealed which military industrial firms they work for.
Central to this is the co-opting and spinning of a media regarded as the freest in the world.
Showdown Iraq. If America goes to war, turn to MSNBC and the experts.
If we journalists, including myself, had right from the get-go, from the opening pop, had started asking the kind of tough, digging, aggressive questions we should have been asking, and doing our reporting, rather than just being kind of stenographers, go to a briefing, have an official say something, print it in the paper next day. If we had done our job, I do think a strong argument can be made that perhaps we would not have gone to war.
The attack on Iraq was sold by these two men, The blueprint for the invasion was this military doctrine called shock and awe, designed to paralyze the country and destroy food production, water supply, and other civilian infrastructure. The effect would be similar to the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan. This was terrorizing people on a grand scale, and it would be covered up by deception in massive amounts. But this was not how it was reported at the time.
Scores of American reporters have now joined U.S. military units in Kuwait as part of the Pentagon's effort to make any war with Iraq what the Pentagon calls a media-friendly campaign.
A new word, embedding, entered media language in the planning for the invasion. Most of the reports that viewers saw came from within a system in which media organizations agreed to certain conditions laid down by the Ministry of Defense in London and the Pentagon in Washington.
At the time that our forces crossed into Iraq, we had some 700 reporters embedded throughout our military formations. Embedding was important for that conflict for a number of reasons. One being that we knew we were going up against an enemy that was somewhat masterful at misinformation, disinformation.
We have a number of correspondents embedded with our troops across the region.
And very deeply embedded in a personal way with the Marine that he's traveling with.
I love this expression for the Iraq War, the embedded journalists. Well, too many journalists have been in bed with the administration on a variety of issues. I would say 80 to 90% of what you read in a newspaper is officially inspired. If they're covering the intelligence community, for example, and they become critical of the CIA or a major intelligence organization, they're going to lose their sources. If they become critical of the Pentagon, it's going to be very difficult to get into the Pentagon to deal with official military sources. So I think journalists like to be part of the game, part of the inside crowd, and therefore the conventional wisdom is the best wisdom.
"24-hour news" in particular is a system that is the most easy to manipulate. 24-hour news is a giant echo chamber. So that's why, for example, Basra was reported as having fallen 17 times before it actually fell. And yet, within 24-hour news, when you're reporting it for the seventh time in that chain of 17 times when the city has fallen falsely, the fact that it's been wrong the previous seven times just doesn't matter.
American armor is moving at will across whole swathes of Baghdad.
This is Raghi Omar reporting for the BBC from Baghdad. He describes the arrival of the Americans as a liberation.
People have come out welcoming them, holding up V signs. This is an image taking place across the whole of the Iraqi capital today.
But it was not happening across the rest of Iraq. This was another illusion. The toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein was seized upon by the invading force as a target of opportunity. What was not news was a US Army investigation describing how they exploited what they called a media circus. "There are almost as many reporters as Iraqis," says the report. It was an American PSYOPs officer who ordered the statue brought down. The resulting TV pictures gave no sense of the bloody conquest of Iraq that was already well underway.
You know, I didn't really do my job properly. I think I'd hold my hand up and say that one didn't press the most uncomfortable buttons hard enough.
As you describe the arrival of the Americans, you didn't tell us the story of how that whole statue was itself manipulated. Mm. Why not?
The entire live cameras of the world's press were on the balcony of the Palestine Hotel. And that was really the only events that they saw about Iraqis coming out. So it was a sort of made-for-TV moment. And the most telling moment in that whole day was when an American soldier climbed up a crane and put the American flag over the statue's face. Because, in fact, that was a true iconic moment of what had happened, that America had taken ownership of Iraq.
In Britain, Blair and Bush's invasion was applauded as a vindication of them and their strategy.
He said that they would be able to take Baghdad without a bloodbath, and that in the end the Iraqis would be celebrating. And on both of those points he has been proved conclusively right, and it would be entirely ungracious, even for his critics, not to acknowledge that tonight he stands as a larger man and a stronger prime minister as a result.
It is absolutely, without a doubt, a vindication of the strategy.
It was a vindication for him. Those who said...
Should they, you know, use a Moab, the mother of all bombs, and a few daisy cutters, and, right. You know, let's not just stop at a couple of cruise missiles.
I've fallen almost in love with the F-18 Super Hornet because it's quite a versatile plane.
I got to tell you, my favorite aircraft, the A-10 Warthog. I love the Warthogs.
The war we don't see in Iraq is largely the massive toll on civilians in Iraq, where daily, even now, people are being killed and wounded because of this occupation.
Open the door!
Seeing what I see, contrasting that with what has been reported by most of the mainstream, it's like two completely different worlds.
In 2004, American Marines twice assaulted the city of Fallujah, the second time with British forces. A nightmare unfolded. The Americans made the city a free fire zone. The UN reported that 70% of the houses were destroyed, and those standing were riddled with bullets. Thousands of civilians were killed. Little of this was shown on the majority TV networks in Britain and America. That the Americans met courageous resistance was not news at all. Viewers did not get a sense of the sheer scale of the suffering of ordinary people. This remarkable film from inside Fallujah was made by an American, Mark Manning, with Rana Al-Ayoubi, an Iraqi. It has never been shown on television. In the wars of today, it's often daring, independent filmmakers like these who give the victims a voice. American journalist Dar Jamal also entered Fallujah independently and revealed that the Americans had used white phosphorus and attacked civilians. His eyewitness dispatches and photographs contradicted the version many people saw and read, but were not published in the mainstream media.
I have photos of trenches being dug, and I watched them burying people there and put little makeshift gravestones, writing anything to try to identify the people. And I walked the rows of these stones after the April siege with one of my interpreters while she read old man in tracksuit with a key in his hand, mother and two children. These were the identifying markers, and these are clearly civilians.
What does embedding do to journalists themselves?
An important distinction between embedded journalists and independent journalists is that when you choose to embed, you're giving the military the full power to control where you go, how you get there, what you see, and when you see it, and in a lot of instances, even how you're going to report that.
Hundreds of thousands of people were forced to evacuate the city, refugees in their own land. They were given nowhere to go. Many are still unable to return. Evidence that the invaders had terrorized civilians was provided by Al Jazeera and other Arab TV networks, whose fearless, unembedded reporters and camera crews became a threat to military propaganda. They gave voice to people who refused to be portrayed simply as victims.
وهي تصيح ماما بابا وين الإنسانية وين الضمير.
I happen to be, I think, the only journalist in the world that has seen the bombing of Al Jazeera Arabic's bureaus in both Kabul in 2001 and in Baghdad in 2003. The case of the bombing of the Al Jazeera office in Kabul was without doubt and categorically a direct targeting of those journalists to shut them up and possibly kill them.
Al Jazeera to inform Washington.
Every news organization.
What you're listening to is John Pilger and his important new documentary. I'm Gary Knoll. That brings up the end of this particular hour. We still have one more hour, but not all stations carry 2 hours. So this program is dealing with a new form of McCarthyism in journalism, the targeting of people such as a John Pilger, such as virtually all the people from Chris Hedges who expose corruption, misinformation, the lies, the propaganda from the Pentagon and corporate America. More to come in a moment. And thank you for listening for this hour.
Of you died. You know we've got to find a way to bring some.